Welcome to the Legacy Podcast Series from Chapter 4 Uganda. Visit us at chapter4uganda.org to subscribe, receive a newsletter and updates on our work and that of our partners on civil liberties in Uganda. Uganda has a long track record of documented human rights violations. These have appeared in books, films, other forms of art. Most violations are the result of state-inspired violence coming from moments of political competition and perceived pressure on state actors. So in this episode, we'll look back at the history of human rights violations through the lens of activists old. I'm not saying you're really old, Andrew Karamaji, but older than Praise. Who is in a Gen Z generation of activists carrying the burden of protesting the continuing violation of human rights. So, I don't know, we'll start with introductions. Andrew, would you give a brief introduction as to who you are and how you came to be in this space and being labeled as a radical activist?
Yes, Andrew Karamaji has introduced. I like to think of myself as an African from a small province called Uganda, whose passport I hold. The story of how I found myself here is a bit lengthy, but the short of it is that a man was going to be executed together with 9 others, and you will know. I'm telling it in this coded way so that I am sure you'll know who it is, alongside 9 others. And in my childish mind, I carried the newspaper in which that story was and took it to my dad because we have this, as kids, you have this impression of your dad as a Superman. Took the newspaper to him and said, "Daddy, you have to save this guy and his friends. I think they're innocent." And then he tells me, "Write a letter to the president of that country." And since my dad was an ambassador, I figured, yeah, maybe this will work. 2 weeks later, the 9 guys and this journalist are executed by hanging, and I go and stage an epic rant at my dad's bedroom door and tell him that when I grow up, I'm going to fight bad people. Maybe that's how I ended up in law school, but might have done anything else anyway. So it's from that childhood disappointment or frustration that I think I find myself here. It's my earliest memory of taking a decision to fight.
And now you're a human rights lawyer, as that's the profession, right?
Yes.
And Praise, I understand you're a law student.
Yes.
And how did you find yourself in this business of fighting bad people?
Oh, yeah. That's an interesting story there. Yeah. So my name is Aloykin Praise Opoloje. I am not Japanese or Chinese. I am an Itesot from Palisa District. And how did I start fighting bad people? I was going to say I blew bubbles like in Henry Danger, but no. So it has been something that was growing, I think, way back when I was little, because I can picture myself doing small protests in ways I don't understand. I wanted to confess something here for the very first time that I've never told anyone, but I'm thinking if I should do it. So I was a head prefect at Seta High School. And things were not going right, and no one seemed to care about how things were going. So I sort of staged my lawn protests by writing these very hilarious things in the bathrooms because I didn't want to get caught or expelled, and as a head prefect. So, yeah, but somehow they caused change, and the administration started to listen to what the students were trying to say. But that was not my tipping point. My tipping point was in August last year when I went to give birth to my first daughter in Palisa Main Hospital. And the condition was so bad. I was in this room. That's where you give birth from, the birthing ward or something. And there are 3-4 beds. There are women on those beds struggling to give birth. And there is one nurse and like 2 interns there with her. And she seems so exhausted. But I'm in my labor pains and I'm not paying attention to it. It's after I give birth and I have a tear and I'm supposed to be stitched. And for over 45 minutes, they have to wait because there is no thread that they can use to stitch me. And I'm bleeding terribly and I keep blacking out. It's not until my mom pulls out 5,000 Ugandan shillings to give to the nurse that thread somehow appears. and they stitched me up. But that was not the end of it. 3 days after giving birth, my baby feels a little ill. I take her to hospital, and that's when I go to the NICU for the first time. And there is this one oxygen tank that they have to keep alternating between the two babies that are there. Then electricity goes. The generator is not working. When electricity comes back, the condenser is not there anymore. And two departments are arguing about the condenser. And this baby is turning blue. And it's like they don't really care. This has happened before. They cannot give their condenser because, you know, the other department lost theirs. And that was my tipping point. When I saw lives going, and these bad people didn't seem to care that these were lives at stake, lives of young, innocent babies. I said I can no longer keep doing this in the most subtle ways of, oh, let me volunteer in this organization and, you know, fight period poverty. Oh, let me volunteer in this organization and train kids about critical thinking, about their civic rights. No, I need to actively partake in this discussion. I need to actively do something about it because impunity keeps growing and my ways are not working. So I think my point was a point of frustration. That's when I decided, okay, let me hit the streets. If death is a price, let me pay it.
Andrew, it's a good time to segue into your time as an activist. What forms of organizing, you know, would you say have been the appropriate counterweight to some of the things that you guys have just said here, particularly state-inspired human rights violations? And how do you judge, you know, public knowledge and concern for such violations? Praise obviously has a very personal story, but it's not uncommon.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yes, whatever form of organizing that we've chosen or I have applied, I have learned to ensure that it meets about three things: rootedness, authenticity, and relevance. Sometimes we have ideas in our heads about what we think is wrong, but the population or the public thinks otherwise. That's the importance of being rooted. Authenticity in the sense that it can't be artificial. It can't be something that you've heard in a seminar held by an NGO or a passing fad, or, you know, it has to be something that is relatable, is real. Praise has just narrated something so profound and very painful. That she has seen it firsthand is disturbing. And then the relevance, how does this connect to the day-to-day lives and struggles? To your second question on public knowledge, I believe that the public knowledge has always existed within our population. The challenge is in translating that which we know into action. If you listen to retirees who have been in the villages since the early 90s who have pulled out of public life, those immediately younger than them, you hear them say things about how certain public facilities collapsed. You hear them relate stories of how life was then, how police was a symbol of safety, security, protection, decency, and so on, how public office was a place to serve, to excel, and so on. Today, my expression, Praise's expression, Angelo's expression of that which is wrong might be different, but at the end of the day, it's that common stock of knowledge on what is wrong with our society.
And keeping on this, Andrew,
Yeah. Obviously
what activists do, what lawyers yourselves do, are just like a portion. There is a standard menu of state institutions that are meant to deal with human rights violations when they occur. Mm-hmm. What is your take on the quality of institutional response to human rights violations of the last, say, 20 years?
The state could not possibly have responded otherwise, in my view, because of its orientation. The Ugandan state or any other post-colonial state, in my view, was never created to serve citizens, more for subjects or residents or inhabitants, but not citizens. So when the state responds the way it does, whether through disregard or actually victimizing those who have been whose rights have been violated, or simply passing laws to criminalize alternative thought, dissent, and so on. It's behaving the way it ought, unfortunately.
But surely, over the last 25 years, there are laws that have been passed, some positive, some negative, enacted to deal with human rights issues. You have institutions like the Human Rights Commission, the Equal Opportunities Commission that have been established and formalized. What has been the impact of these interventions?
It's cliche, I know, but the devil is in the details. If you look at how, if you follow the money in terms of funding for the Equal Opportunities Commission, for example, or if you see how the Uganda Human Rights Commission literally, not figuratively, begs for funding, if you see how the Family and Child Protection Unit in the police is treated as a by the way, you could say that for the courts, for probation and welfare officers, for the prisons or the correctional criminal justice system, it's clear that most of these have been created, or these laws have been passed, perhaps to meet donor requirements or to look good on the international stage, without any real intent around changing, turning around the fortunes of human rights in the country.
Praise, recently you were arrested and detained for a protest. In what way is this form of activism making your voices heard and, as you said earlier, addressing some of the discrepancies in the way government services are rendered? How is this form of protest contributing to change that you feel that will come forth in the next, you know, in the next few years, or perhaps in your child's generation?
So I think I would want to borrow from what Andrew has said and start on the point of, you know, having a rooted sort of movement. So this movement, the March to Parliament movement, has different branches to it. There is the online mobilization branch, where we have young people hosting spaces every day for the past 4 weeks. Hosting spaces. And on these spaces, the conversations are around what is going wrong. What does corruption look like in parliament? The corruption that we are seeking to fight. Because we know this corruption is found in different places, but this movement is focusing on parliamentary corruption, you know. And, you know, not all the corruption that happens in parliament is blatant. It's out there. It's not all allowances of 500 million for two generators. No, some of it is even lawful, past, like the service awards. So you have to explain to people how that is also wrong. So I think the first way that we are feeding into the fight against corruption is that sensitizing masses and breaking this down in ways that they can understand and relate to. Because when you tell me, for example, that we lose $1 trillion a year to corruption, I may not relate to a trillion. I don't know what a trillion is. I know it's big, big, big money, but I cannot relate to it. But when someone breaks it down and tells me, okay, you know, this 1.5 billion that was given out in service awards can buy this number of pads for girls for an entire year, or it can pay this number of nurses for this number of years, then people start to relate. We can even go as down as breaking this down to things like how many chapatis it could buy for you, how many Rolexes it could buy for you, such that each and everyone can understand how bad it is. Because the narrative is that we are a poor country, and someone want to buy that. I want to agree that maybe we are poor, yeah, that's why we borrow money, like all African countries are. But then you show people that this very poor country is the one that is giving dressing, furniture, and bedding allowances to someone already earning 40 million and above. This very poor country is the same country that is going to have regional sittings, parliamentary sittings, not any different. The only different thing is more money is going to be spent and these guys are going to have tour experience of sorts. And yet, here are your problems. Interns just need 18 billion. Give them that money.
Here you're talking about how much public officials actually earn versus the reality of the ordinary person.
Exactly. So we feed into that. But also trying to show people that may not necessarily be affected by these things, you know, like the Karamajis. Your life may not be at the worst place, but there's a reason. You have a certain privilege, and that privilege should be used to fight for people that may not have access to this information because they don't own smartphones, because I've not gone to school. So that's also part of what we do, ensuring that the comfortable also join on and have this conversation. Now, the physical march is just something that comes out of frustration, the impunity in the country, that people are seeing these things happen. we are trying to point them to this direction, but they still don't want to do anything about it. You understand? So the physical march is a form of pressure, a form of, if you don't do something, we are going to do something about it. And this is the best way that we have.
Hmm. So what human rights issues, praise, do you think most important to the younger generation of activists like yourself?
Yes. So I think, one, we could start with health, because every young person somehow find themselves sick one way or the other. And you're going to go to a hospital, which is a public hospital, like the one I talked about, the Palisa Main Hospital. And still at the end of the day, there's not going to be any drugs there. You understand? You're going to have to pay someone to get access to these drugs. That's if you're lucky. Someone today on X made a post that if you want to understand how bad it is in this country, you need to go to Malago and see people carrying their intestines in their hands and being sent to fast pharmacy to buy drugs only to come back and die. So that's the first place, but also civically, because, you know, young people are people that are interested in the issues, political issues of their country. But every day in this country, the civic space shrinks, that holding something as simple as a demonstration is regarded as a terrorist action. So in a place where young people, who are the majority in this country, are not even allowed the right to point out what's wrong in their country without facing, you know, some weird charges against them, then it becomes problematic, because the largest population is trying to point you to an actual issue which is affecting their livelihood, which is perpetuating evil such as lack of employment. Like, look at the medical interns, look at the scenario that is happening now around LDC and students that are just leaving different law schools. So when that democratic civic right is taken away from these young people, it leaves them hopeless. It gives them no hope and takes away one of their greatest duties as citizens in their own country, you know, to actualize as citizens at the end of the day. So the health, but also the unemployment that still comes out of, you know, this whole corruption thing, mismanagement of office, abuse of power, people having to pay to get jobs. You know, people usually say that, you know, let's have dialogues in this country. But these dialogues are not just money, are like monologues. They have now become monologues. How much can you pay to get a certain service? How can you access it? So young people cannot keep living like that.
So, ladies and gentlemen, social media has become now an integral part of how we interact with each other, how we express our needs, and obviously how we protest when those needs are not met. Andrew, how has this changed the landscape? You participated in the Black Monday protests. How old were you then?
I was 24. Yeah, 23, 24, 25. Yes.
Just about the same age as Praise, yeah. Right now.
Mm.
So there is a contrast there. You're both activists, young activists at the time. But how has social media changed the way activism is done? Your take, Andrew?
My take is that in the initial phase, I thought that, you know, whatever it is we're fighting will change tomorrow. If we say end corruption now, because I've written an article and it has 5,000 likes, yeah, now things are going to get moving. And, you know, we're going to have 1 million people on the streets. And the confirmation is that it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. And that social media has to be rooted in the long, tedious, boring groundwork of organizing, so that you don't end up with a situation described in a book titled by Tufekci, titled Twitter and Tear Gas. There has to be a connection between social media, as fantastic as it is, as wonderful as it is, as you see our brothers and sisters in Kenya have done. You can see the connection between the virtual and the in-person organizing. Yeah. So the change for me is there's more amplification of voice, of all voices, but it's amplifying what already exists. You can't build it from social media. It has to come from the, so to say, ground up.
Praise, the algorithm and the activist, how is it affecting the way you do your work?
I think in line with what Andrew says, he says that, you know, social media is just, you know, amplifying what has been there before, you know. I agree with that. And for me, the most beautiful thing that social media has done is that it has broken the monopoly from the traditional media that we had. And, you know, especially in a place where, you know, traditional media had its limits, where, you know, you can't say some things because they'll censor you. Those that tried were censored before. But now, yeah, even though it still exists, we have people being arrested, put away. You can't arrest and put away everyone. But also it has given birth to a new form of activism whereby an organization, here I'm speaking of organizations like Agora or Public Square, can just come up and their job is simple as letting people know facts. And I think it's the biggest facilitation for whistleblowers. I've never seen the Whistleblowers Act make more sense than with this social media activism. Because before, you could go whistleblow to the police and, you know, it could, they could choose not to ever bring that stuff out. Oh. But now, because we have people...
It's not a whistle, it's a megaphone, no?
Uh-huh. Now, that is
and
it.
It's self-published.
Exactly. So the moment this comes out, and it has its disadvantages, but in our situation, I feel like it has borne more advantages than disadvantages. But also how far and how deep our message reaches, you know, in a place where it's hard for me to say, oh, Karamaji, let us go to Gulu maybe and have a conversation with these people about the issues happening in Parliament. You know, I cannot just sit and record my video. I know that the more people like it or retweet it, yeah, this person may get to know this. And now the information is a little bit different. Like I said already, it's not just corruption, this big animal. It is corruption with this name, with this figure, which would have done this for you, but it's not doing that for you. So it empowers sort of everyone in their own docket to translate in their own languages, to use their best people rap these days, people, you know, do all that kind of stuff. But also, like he says, I agree that there is need for us to translate that online energy to physical energy. Now, I'm not telling people to go and burn tires and do what, but just to peacefully demonstrate or to actively do something, you know, because we have to also accept and understand that in as much as the online activism has done what it has done, the impunity has also stuck. That's why the speaker can come up and say in public, people still don't share with you. That's why Chitezi can have people being buried under rubbish. And the president has never set foot there, but he's going for Thanksgivings everywhere in the country. So there is need for us to realize that this beautiful online work should be coupled with physical, actual activity in our different capacities.
So finally, ladies and gentlemen, Andrew, what's your next project?
I can't share the title, but it's something I'm writing. And I'm doing it requires a lot of investigation, and I hope you guys will raise money for, and those listening, for bail when I finally release it. Thank you. That's my next project.
And praise, are you planning to go back to jail as well?
Yeah.
Andrew's already plotting, you know, he has his
jail is inevitable because, you know, fighting the bad guys in this country is criminalized. So definitely jail is one of the good things to actually expect, you know, there are worse things that could happen. So jail is a fair
part.
Yeah,
it's a popular meme. I think it's wrong to be right. It's dangerous to be right when the government is wrong.
Exactly.
Something like, yes. Yeah.
So prison is the fair card here. But I think my focus right now is around women and girls. I want to have more voices, not just voices, but actually actual actions from young women and girls. So when I got into Luzira, my major focus was how do I concretize the spirit of fighting bad guys in these women that were there. And it worked. So we are working on a number of things that we can't disclose, so they're not sabotaged. But yeah, that's where we are, focusing on young women because they need their voices to be out there, especially as a group of people that have been oppressed before. They should not let this continue.
And for those who are wondering who the 9 and 1 people who were hanged are, it's Ken Sarawiwa and others who were hanged for their story on Shell's pollution of Ogoni land.
This is the Ogoni movement in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in this Legacy podcast series, and we hope to host you again sometime.